Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have in the studio Brittany Spanos and Simon Vozek-Levinson. Hey. So, in a recent issue of Rolling Stone, we did a list of the best songs of the 21st century so far, and it's actually our sort of our second stab at it because we did the best songs of the 2000s. And it was done with a poll of writers and artists, and there's 100 songs on it. And I thought we would devote several podcasts to kind of going through the list, and in doing so, talking to some of the people who made some of the songs on the list. And today we're going to start that. We're going to start at the bottom of the list, and we're going to try to talk to Amaury, who did the amazing song One Thing in 2005. And it's we'll play it in a minute if you don't remember it, but it's just this phenomenal, incredibly rhythmic R&B song that has strong elements of hip-hop. It was one of the first songs, like Crazy in Love, which was produced by Rich Harrison, the same great producer. The way she's riding the beat is very much a hip-hop thing, and that blurring the lines is actually one of the key things of I would say, 21st century pop, right?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that One Thing prefigured a lot of what we hear now. It's the sort of creative use of sampling, the way that her voice kind of floats over the beat sounds incredibly current now, as fresh as it did in 2005.
Yeah, and I think just bringing R&B and pop together and fusing it in that way was really just kind of almost unheard of before the 2000s. So I think that song is like the best example of what, like you said, what we're hearing now, what we hear through every pop star at this moment, kind of this like R&B pop fusion.
And the other song we're going to be talking about later is Tighten Up by the Black Keys. And Patrick Carney is of the Black Keys is going to be calling in to talk about that song. And the funny thing is they actually have a similar kind of beat, we were saying. The One Thing was created from a sample of a Meters song. And it's kind of, it's very syncopated on the snare. And Patrick Carney on Tighten Up really plays his own version, his own sort of punk rock version of that kind of beat. So I love that. And these songs are both in sort of the 80 to 100 range. And it's a nice little connection there. But I mean, Rich Harrison, we should talk about him for a minute. I mean, he is a sort of one of the key producers of the first part of the first decade of the 21st century. God, that sounds so historic now. And he came from the tradition of late 20th century hip hop of finding the great loop in an old soul song and knowing what to do with it. Because it's not just a matter of, here, let's slice this loop out, this one bar of James Brown or a Meter song and then rap over it or sing over it. It's like you pick that bar, you put it in, and then you're putting all the stuff on top of it and knowing what to put in the rest of the song and doing it. And that's what made him, a super key producer. It's kind of a bridge between that 20th century style and what was to come. And I think we have Amaury on the air right now. Hi, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we were just talking about the greatness of One Thing, which is both on our current list of the greatest songs of the 21st century and is also on our previous list of the greatest songs of the 2000s. You have a lot of great songs, and this is a truly amazing song, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the making of it. You collaborated, a ton with Rich Harrison in those days.
Yeah.
Tell us about how that relationship worked and what you liked about his producing style, all that.
Well, we initially met because we had a mutual friend. At the time, he'd had a couple of records that he'd placed with Mary J. Blige, I believe, and he was still kind of like building his own company, his own vibe. And I was at the time, I was at university, and we had a mutual friend and introduced us, and we ended up meeting, and he played me some of his tracks, and I played him some of the music that I'd been working on at the time with different people, and just singing some songs that I'd written. And I don't know, I just felt like there's definitely something there. And we just got to work like a week later. And most of what we ended up creating at the time ended up being the first album.
Mm.
And in fact, we actually went to, once we got the quote unquote big record deal, then we went to the quote unquote real studio and re-sang everything and redid everything. He messed around with some of the track a little bit. And then we realized, the stuff that we recorded in the basement sounds like that first time around, it just had the magic to it. Let's just keep what we had. So a lot of the first album is actually those are records that are recorded in the basement next to like a washing machine and a dryer.
That's awesome.
All that stuff, you know. You know, I always feel like that's why I love working with new producers, just unknown people who at the time would probably say I'm an aspiring producer or working and creating in spaces. Like, I never liked going to really big, flossy, glossy studios because I always felt like it was like a step away from just like the pureness of like just the creation. Like, you know, of course, anytime you're creating anything, once you bring in, like, once you monetize it, it's kind of like, no matter how you look at it, it always takes away a little of the purity. I mean, you can really try to come from a pure place, but the back of your mind, you're still thinking, what do other people think when they hear it? What will they think? What are they expecting? And even though you try to, like, shut that out, it's really hard. So I feel like when you're creating in what I call, like, the lab, and you're feeling like you're doing it for the first time, and it's just raw energy, I always just feel like it comes out better that way.
Totally.
Personally. And with one thing, it was a little different because we were in a big studio. Well, it wasn't like the biggest studio in New York. We were in New York City. I just remember the session being like, we had a large room, but the booth was small, so I like that. There were a lot of guacamole Doritos involved. And I think... like, I was literally eating them between takes because I'm kind of a glutton. So bad. But, like, I couldn't wait. So, and also it kind of was, like, my treat because Rich is really tough in the studio. And now I produce myself a lot. So I'm glad that we went through that because I'm as tough on myself as he was on me in the beginning when I was, like, really starting. And I mean, we would just do take and take and take of a yeah, yeah, oh, and it's like oh, and he didn't mean it in a rude way, but it's just again, no, and that would become our like our running joke,
right?
But we would record really, we had a really fast process of recording, and I record like that now, so sometimes engineers have to get used to it because I can sound rude, but it's because that's the way we worked, and we were just like really to the point, you know, there's just like, you're just trying to get out as much as you can in a certain amount of time. That's why I started engineering myself actually now too. That way it just goes really fast. I don't even have to say again, it's just like, I just do it. But, yeah, it's really just like an awesome session.
So what do you remember about first hearing the beat, the track? Was he still working on it when he brought it to you, or did he say, hey, check this out? How did that all work?
No, for the most part it was done. He had it on a demo tape. Whoa, I think it was a tape. Huh. I don't even think we know what to do with those now. But it was actually like on a tape. And yeah, that's the way he works. He actually, the way Rich works is he has to go into his hole. He creates, and then he comes back, and then you can like start tweaking things. You work on it from there. But he's not a make it in front of me right now. Let's just bounce back and forth as we go. Creator, he creates, he goes, finishes his thought, and then he comes, and then you collaborate after that. But he needs to finish his thought so he knows what he's working with first. And at first I was like, whoa, this is crazy. It sounded like go-go, you know, very go-go, and it's not a go-go record, but the way that he sampled the meters, that what he chose and the way he looped it, gave it this go-go, this super go-go flavor, which lives in him because he's from D.C., and that's where we met. So I just thought, whoa, and there's a lot happening in this track. There's a lot happening. And it sounded so different from what was on the radio. I mean, there's nothing that sounded like that. And there's been nothing that sounds like that since, honestly. But I liked it right away. And when we recorded it, we looked at each other and we were like, this is something. But, you know, you just never really know. You never really know how everyone else is going to like it. You just know how you feel about it. And if you think if you've got something there. But that's the thing, you just never know how it's going to be received. And it had a very mixed reception when we took it to the label.
I was curious how the melody and the sort of cadence and the lyrics sort of came together.
Well, Rich had most of the song already finished. The bridge was kind of like empty, if I remember correctly. So I went off and wrote the bridge on my own at another time. Well, we recorded everything, and then I went back and I recorded the bridge later.
So would he have?
As far as
did he sing on the demo? Like, who was, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like
he,
oh, that's
no,
cool.
He sings on the demos, and I always liked that. Later on, he would feel like, should I get a girl to sing on the demos? And I was like, no, I don't like to hear things because they sound very raw when he sings it. Like, he sings it, what, he's not a singer. So it's kind of like more of the idea of what it should sound like. And that gave me room to do my own interpretation of things, if you know what I mean, versus having someone who's polished who's singing it. Because then, to me, then it's cemented already.
Yeah.
But when you have Rich singing it, that he's not a singer, and it's kind of funny, but you get the general gist of where he's going with it, then it's like, okay, I can interpret it myself. Yeah, so that was really great.
There's also a really cool little spoken word thing that you do in there with the breathing and the, you know.
Oh yeah, it's funny because those are the things. Like I said, there's a lot of now I can get those things really quick. But let me tell you, sometimes just getting a yeah, that stuff takes longer than the singing part.
Because
you think you're just saying yeah. But then when you start doing it more, you start getting a lot more self-conscious, and it's like, yeah. It's just like it took so long, but we had a great time. We had a ball recording.
And I want to finish by talking about the label's crazy reaction to it, but let's, with no further ado, let's actually hear some of One Thing. So how many na-na-na-na-na-ohs did you have to do before you got there, right?
A whole bunch. Because if you're off key, it's going to sound weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like I was, yeah.
Like, and it has to be the perfect breath between the, especially when you go down to the O. You know, people still ask me what I'm saying in that part. Because a lot of people were like, she's saying gobble, gobble, gobble. I'm like, why would I be saying that? Why would I say that?
So then you take this song that, I mean, I think we all, sitting here, we all remember the first time we heard it. And I, you know, literally the first time I heard it, it practically knocked me out of my chair. It's one of those songs. It's so obviously, at the time, it was both so obviously great and groundbreaking and sort of irresistible. And yet, as with so many things that have become classics, the label didn't get it, right?
Yeah, they didn't really get it. At the time, I remember one of the descriptions was that it's so linear, and I was like, okay. And I guess it kind of does kind of stay on one track. It doesn't really have a bunch of changes. The bridge kind of does that a little bit, but it's not really supposed to be like your traditional song where it's like taking you here and then you go up here and then you go back down and then it was more of a vibe. And I think that we're definitely at that place now, or these days you just do whatever. I mean, I've heard songs where, you know, the whole song is just the hook, or there's a verse and then there's a hook, and then the second verse is really just the first verse again.
Mm.
You can just do whatever you want. And I think that there's a lot of overthinking. But, I mean, you know, you have to really respect the people who have been doing it for a really long time. So, I mean, it's all so subjective. I was just like, I don't really understand. Like, how do you just, aside from breaking it down and you're trying to overthink it, but don't you just hear that it just sounds cool? But then there was like, oh, because then I remember there were some different iterations that came. One thing, I'm one of those grouchy artists. Like, I create and I like to create. Rich is a little like that too. You know, we like to get in our little hole, create, and then it's like, that's that. Because some artists create, I don't know, we're going to open a whole can of worms.
Yeah.
But long story short, you can create because you want to, your whole idea is just like, I just want to get on stage, or I just want to be famous, and I just, you know, want to be loved. All artists have part of that in them, right? But a big part for me was just the creative process. To me, I was like, I love the creative process. If I didn't have to make any videos or go anywhere, I could just like record the music, make the music, send it out, and that's good.
Yeah.
So to me, when you took that part away, it's like, what am I doing this for? I don't do it for the photo shoot because I don't particularly enjoy them like that. So I do it to create. because I have something to say. So when the label sends you different versions of your song with terrible hooks on them, and someone else is like, how about you do the hook like this? And one was like, it's just one thing. Just one thing. I was like, what? What is this? And I was like, you know, after we got over our anger, we were just like, look, it is, we have the right thing. Please don't send any more of these one thing hook versions. We're overthinking it. We like it just the way it is. We respect your opinion, but we're going to have to disagree on this one. And then it was, good from there.
Yeah.
It helped that the song took off on its own, though.
Right.
Great.
Well, it was a top 10 single. And it's on our list, but you know, even if it wasn't, it's an all time classic. Do you guys want to jump in at all? Are we good?
I mean, have you heard it randomly in the time since? I feel like I still hear it everywhere, like in stores or you know.
I do. And even when I'm traveling overseas, I'll hear it. I feel like it's used on the news a lot for some reason. Like, which I find like so interesting, like, oh, okay, like especially weather. I've heard that a few times. And then of course, like walking through a mall or cafe or a store, anything like that. I think we were in Amsterdam, and I walked past a coffee shop, and it was playing right then. It's really weird when you're there. For some reason, that's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, but, right.
Because you're like, oh, I feel this is really weird, especially if you walk into a store and it's playing. It's like, oh, it's kind of embarrassing. Did they play that because I walked in, and then they kind of felt like obligated to play it, or it's kind of like, I don't know. But it's really cool.
It's like really hail to the chief for the president. Yes. Thanks again so much for joining us. It was a pleasure speaking
with
you.
Thank you guys so much.
Have a great day.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun walking down memory lane.
Thanks again. And so you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. That was the great Amory talking about her super classic song, One Thing, part of our list of the greatest songs of the 21st century so far. You're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back with Patrick Carney talking about the Black Keys, Tighten Up.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Bleav Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
And now we're going to talk to Patrick Carney of the Black Keys about their great song, Tighten Up, that's also on the list. And, you know, with Amory, we broke down how she kind of rode that beat and made a very different song for the world. In this case, this is a very different song for the Black Keys. They were, you know, essentially a garage blues band, and they got together with Danger Mouse and made something altogether different and transform their career. And I think we have Mr. Patrick Carney on the line right now. Patrick.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm well. I'm trying to quit smoking. 3 days into it.
I think we picked the wrong time to talk to you, man.
Good. I just have a 1,000 toothpicks on my feet.
So it's funny, we were saying that, so we just talked to Amory about One Thing, and I don't know how clearly you remember One Thing, but the beat is not altogether different from the Tighten Up beat. I don't know if you agree.
That song has like a meters.
Exactly.
Example.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, the beat to Tighten Up, that song started with the drum beat, actually. And, it's weird because, see, Dan and I, it was 8 years ago, almost to the day, that Dan and I started making our album Brothers in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And we spent like a little bit less than 2 weeks down there just basically making a song up a day and recording it. And we got back our home. I was living in New York at the time. Dan was still in Ohio. And it took a while to get some rough mixes in. And during that time, I just thought maybe we should go back in the studio and, like, try to write one more song. So I called Dan, and I called I thought we should do it with Danger Mouse because we'd done that record just brothers just on our own. And Dan was up to try something with Danger Mouse. So we met up in New York in early December with nothing. And we were actually promoting this hip-hop record that Dan and I made called Black Rock. And we were doing some TV. We're doing, like, Letterman and whatever other TV show, I guess, you do in New York with Colin Fallon or whatever. We were doing those performances during the afternoon, and then in the evening we went to the Bunker in Brooklyn to record. And that song started with the drum beat. It was me basically trying to play a krautrock kind of can vitamin C type beat. You know?
Huh. But not a motoric beat, like a different kind of krautrock beat. Yeah.
They're not like motoric. I mean, it's just the beat. It's the beat from Vitamin C. I don't even know what the hell it is. But
right.
The first time I heard Camp, I was 16. I was my uncle was a musician. I went to visit him in San Francisco, and he had these records just lined up across the wall of his apartment, and just incredible stuff I'd never heard of. It was funny because he was really excited about taking me to Amoeba, the record store, you know, because I'd never been to Amoeba or a record store nearly that big. But after being in his apartment, going to Amoeba, was kind of unimpressed. I was less impressed than Amoeba because my uncle had this curated record store basically in his house, and one of the records he played me was whatever the Can record is with the song Vitamin C on it.
It's like, I can't even pronounce it. It's like E.G. Bamyasi is the album.
Yeah, it means canned okra in Turkish.
Are you serious?
Right. Yeah, for real. It's like a picture of a can of okra.
Oh, it is indeed a picture of okra. I'm looking at the can of cover. Yeah. Okay. Simon can translate Turkish for us. tell us one other phrase in Turkish, Simon.
That's all. Okay. I only know the ones that are on covers of can albums. That's all I know.
Sorry. Continue, Patrick.
Well, I mean, that's the beginning of the story of the making of that song. It started with that drum beat. And we just started throwing a bunch of shit at the wall, and actually, you know, the weird thing is that, you know, that track really, it should have been credited as a co-write with Brian Burton, a.k.a. Danger Mouse. But we were so naive that we were like, oh, that's kind of what a producer does in the studio, blah, blah. And then, you know, the harmonic aspect of that is, like, Dan and I've gotten, we've paid our dues back to music by working on songs and not getting the karma, not getting the credit, you know.
Right.
Well, and then, you know, realize it's chalk it up. It's just a young band not knowing what the hell's going on or whatever. But, yeah, Brian should have gotten credit because the entire arrangement of, like, this song should have this intro. We should then do some sort of tempo change, half, you know, like two-thirds into it. Just the thought of what should happen in the track was Brian, you know.
Totally. Well, let's hear Tighten Up for a minute if we can. What do you remember about the intro of that song coming together?
It was Dan's melody, but it was my idea to whistle it.
good idea.
You know, the main thing about the song is we got into it, the song to the point where it's like maybe 2 minutes and 20 seconds long, and then the conversation kind of moves into this thing where it's like, we'd never had a song played on the radio, you know what I mean? So we're like, oh, Brian's like, this is pretty catchy, like, I don't know. But, like, we couldn't just put another chorus on it, it would be annoying. So Brian was like, we should do something like where the tempo just drops. And, like, it's just almost like the outro slash bridge slash just, you know, take the song somewhere else. So I went into the live room and Dan picked up a bass and I was playing the drums. And I came up with the beat to the outro, and then Dan came up with the bass line. And then I came up with a little fill that could connect the two. And it started kind of shaping up as a thing. And, you know, the interesting thing is like, while we were in the studio making it, like, I was kind of aware, like, this might be the poppiest song the Black Keys have ever made, you know?
Right.
But I mean, in our vocabulary, the word pop is probably much different than most people's. It's hardly kind of a pop song, really. But it's an interesting fact about that song. After we finished it, we spent 2 days recording it, writing it, and we sent it off to Chad Blake, who was mixing that record for us and has mixed every album since Brothers for us. And we got the mix back from Chad, and Dan and I both were pretty uncomfortable with the song just because Brothers had come about in this purely kind of organic way where there was just no Pro Tools, there was no editing, there was no, I don't know. It was in Alabama in like 100-degree weather. I don't know. And we were kind of concerned that like the energy of that song didn't fit on the album. But Dan was a little bit more so than I guess. But I ended up, it came time, so that was like early December, so like then here we are now, early February, I guess, we had to get the sequence together. And we had taken that song a few weeks earlier and recorded a different version of it with a different chorus in Akron. And at the time, early February 2011, that was going to be like, we were going to use a version from Akron, but I had my friend Leon Michaels come over to my apartment. We were hanging out in Manhattan, and I played him everything that we had recorded for the next record. And the last song I played was Tighten Up. I was like, I don't know if we're going to put this on there. He's like, you're a complete idiot. You don't put that song on your record. He's like, whatever. He's like, how long is your record? I'm like, I don't know. It's already like 15 songs. He's like, well, just take one off and put it on, or just put it on as well. Like, you're a moron. I was like, you know what, dude? You're totally right. Like, what are we thinking?
Right.
I texted Dan right then. I was like, we got to put Tighten Up on the record. He's like, whatever you want.
Just stop texting me. No, so just kidding.
He was like, I don't know. We just didn't know what was going on at that point anymore. But it's weird. The song came out April 1st. It came out, and initially we got some like feedback from our management or from the label or whatever that like, you know, some radio stations didn't really fit the format or whatever. And to me, at the time, it was just like, no surprise. We'd never gotten anything played on the radio before. And I wasn't surprised, but I was more surprised when we came back from a European run festival tour mid-July mid-July 2010. And so it was 9 years ago that we started making that record. Wow. Not eight. Mid-July 2010, I come back from this tour, and I get a call from our manager, John Pete, and he's like, you know, Tighten Up, like, it's like number, like, 12 on the alternative charts. And I was like, what does that mean? He's like, I don't know. It's like the highest it's ever been. And he's like, I don't know. So I was like, I don't really know. I went left for tour. We'd go and play Lollapalooza. Dan decides he's going to move to Nashville, so I decide I'm going to move here, too. Next thing I know, it's like October 2010. Dan and I both just moved to Nashville. I'm like unpacking the moving van. Actually, I wasn't doing that, but I was just arriving back to Nashville. And we find out that the song went to number one on the alternative charts. And then after that, it was just like it just wouldn't go away. And we got our first offer to play SNL. And we got all this kind of stuff happening. And yeah, it was kind of the beginning of... I guess of us actually kind of breaking through, you know what I mean? So it was strange because it almost didn't happen. Yeah, we didn't record it initially, and then once we recorded it, we almost didn't put it on the record. And then once it came out, we were told it wasn't going to do shit. So it's like every time like someone, you know, it's funny because like sometimes you'll hear people like different, I don't know, someone used to work for Warner Brothers or whatever, try to take some credit for like the key success or something, and be like, man. You're a fucking idiot because it's a complete accident. No one knows that better than Dan and I because we were like dumbasses, almost didn't put that song out.
And before you go, I know you got a lot going on, like a lot, but
I've got my first child on the way any moment now.
Like any second. I didn't know if we wanted us to mention it, but yeah, congratulations, man. It's all the more, we're all the more grateful to have you. And another another big arrival coming, another breakthrough. And obviously that's going to take up your time for the near future. But I do want to ask, I've heard murmurings that you and Dan are talking about another Black Keys project at the moment.
Well, we've always planned on making another record, and we will do it at some point, because we just burned out a little bit from the, we spent so much time on the road over a 5-year period that it started becoming like, if the next time we make a record, like, how do we avoid not having to spend 220 days every year away from our houses?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, as soon as we figure that out, I'm sure we'll make a record. We'll release like a Aerosmith style video game. are you familiar with their video game?
I remember the Journey arcade game, which was awesome. I knew their arcade game before I knew their music, but I wasn't familiar with the Aerosmith one.
Well, the Aerosmith game is like the Terminator game from like the early 90s where there's just a machine gun.
Oh, 100%, yes.
Yeah, that's the Aerosmith game as well. And you know what? I'll just give you a little anecdote, just a bonus thing, because it's just worth putting out there.
Sure.
And Dan and I played the MTV Movie Awards, I guess it was, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And Johnny Depp, like, the whole thing was that Johnny Depp was going to play guitar with us. And it was like one of those things where it's like, okay, like, I guess we'll do that. We're already in Los Angeles. Johnny Depp seems cool to me. Like, you know? Why not? And it's probably the last time we'll ever be on MTV. We're like pushing 40, and that, you know, they don't really have much music on that station anymore. Whatever. It was just one of those things. We just did it, and I'm glad we did, because we got introduced. The whole song and Johnny Depp, we were introduced by Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, right? So then we go and we play the song, and afterwards, like, we're standing outside behind the amphitheater in Los Angeles, and like Dan, Johnny Depp, Joe Perry, Steven Tyler, and me. And everyone has all this, like, rock star kind of accessories on. And it's, like, in order. Steven Tyler, or actually, Johnny Depp has the most, then Steven Tyler, then Joe Perry. And
you mean, like, necklaces on, like, and bracelets scarves. And stuff, and scarves, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Dan, you know, he has, like, a bracelet on and, like, one ring, and then I just have nothing. It's just, like, it's all in order. And I feel like the odd man out. But then, there's just this thing. I've just started thinking about the eras of the video game, and then I'm looking at these guys, and then they start talking, just Steven Tyler to Joe Perry, and Joe, they're like, how are we going to get our stuff out to Minnesota? And I'm just so nosy. I'm like, what do you guys have a show in Minnesota? He's like, yeah, we got a tour. We're playing the Minnesota State Fair. And I was like, well, what do you have to get out there? He's like, you know, just some stuff. I was like, well, what? Like, can't you just fly it? He's like, Joe Perry looks at me like, we tour with a goddamn arsenal. And then Steven Tyler looks at me like, hand grenades, machine guns. And then I was like, what? He's like, yeah, our buses are loaded down with guns. He's like, you can't just travel around this country without weaponry. And I'm thinking, like, their fucking Aerosmith video game is in real life. This is just some bullshit. I'm glad I learned that. I'm going to let you guys go on that.
Yeah, no. Wow. Thank you for that information, Patrick Carney, and and best of luck and best wishes from all of us. And really appreciate you joining while you got such exciting stuff happening.
Thank you. All right, guys, have a good weekend.
You too. I did not know about this Aerosmith video game. I knew about Aerosmith. I think it's Aerosmith Guitar Hero,
yeah.
Which was, but they had like a shooter, a first person shooter game in arcades, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was about like the dangers of the road and all the risks that you encounter when you're out there being Aerosmith.
My God! And so you had to shoot things?
I think like, so. Yeah, that's the terrible question.
Did you have to shoot like competing bands or like who were the villains?
Yeah, that's a good
question.
Seems
like a key question.
Yeah.
Or like songwriters demanding credit for the, you know, like Desmond Child when he says, actually, I wrote that hook.
Yeah. I think it was like shady promoters and like,
oh my God.
Oh.
Kind of so some kind of like weird revenge fantasy from the addled minds of Steven Tyler.
And question, yeah.
That is so crazy. I spent several days with Steven Tyler. He mentioned another kind of weaponry that actually I'm not allowed to specify. Actually, he let's just say he does have self-protective equipment.
Was it a nunchuck?
It was not a nunchuck. Yeah, it was like that. Yeah, he was doing nunchucks. No, it was not a nunchuck. I definitely would not mess with Steven Tower is what I did learn. But I had a good time with him. But he did not mention the machine guns. But anyway, so we're going to talk a little bit more about this list. I think we're going to have a bunch of episodes devoted to it. But, you know, even in the bottom 10, there's so much great stuff. There's this song, Archie Marry Me by Always. And Simon wanted to talk real fast about that because I think he really pushed hard for this to be on the list.
I did. I really advocated for this song to be on our list. Always are one of my favorite bands of the last decade. They are a Canadian indie pop group.
Spelled A-L-V-V-A-S, but gone.
But pronounced Always. And they make this just sort of beautiful, witty, dreamy, very catchy indie pop in the vein of kind of early Belle and Sebastian. This song is perfect as far as I'm concerned. It ended up ranked at number 98 out of 100. I would have placed it much higher, but I'm glad it made the list.
Well, what number specifically of the top 100 songs of the 21st century?
Number 13.
Damn, dude. Okay.
It's a really good song.
Well, let's hear it. Let's hear that song.
You expressed explicitly.
It is a nice little song. I don't know about number 12, but it's a nice little song. And you should get a thank you note from each member of Always. The Always video game is awesome. It's more of a role-playing thing, but it's pretty complex. At number 97 is 1901 by Phoenix. Great song, great band.
I advocated for that one too. Really good song. It's a classic.
Let's hear that if we can, and we're going to be wrapping up the show pretty soon, but... songs that came out in 2009 and in my head came out in 2006. I don't know why. It's just there's nothing, because a lot of these things aren't, there's nothing tying them to that year. It could have come out in 2006.
Yeah, it summed up, I think, a lot of trends from the first decade of the 2000s.
Yeah, it's definitely like the festival core rock of that era. Like when I hear that song, I just
yes,
think
exactly.
Of like,
and that's I think years. That's I think why it's, because for me 2006 is like the, you know, because it's literally the center of that mm-hmm. decade, and this does feel like the center of the decade. But I can't believe that was in any danger of not making it. How quick the festival core of the past slips away. And then, of course, Tighten Up was at 96. And we've got a whole lot more of this list to go through, and we will on future episodes, and hopefully get some of the makers of the songs to join us, because that's a lot of fun. You know, was putting this list together fun for everyone, or was it kind of a little bit agonizing?
I think it was mostly fun. Music critics love nothing more than to argue about songs.
Right. It's as you know, lists are not my thing, but I like, once they're done, I like talking to the people who are on them. But a lot of, you know, rock critics think in lists, and this is a perfect example for them to, you know, come very close to murdering each other over minutia. So it makes everyone happy.
Perfect.
So this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. Thanks to Brittany Spanos and Simon Vozek-Levinson for joining me, and thanks very much to Amory and Patrick Carney for talking about making some of the greatest songs of this century, which is insane. And we'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes, and we will see you next week. As always, thanks for listening.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot.
But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.